It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running on this, the 25th day of November 2019. This is the final week of November 2019. It's also Thanksgiving week. And in terms of a program note, just a reminder for the week that each program this week will be truncated to 2 hours because tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday, I'll be filling in for Malloy. And then Thursday, assuming everything is, well, as close to normal as anything around here ever is, and remembering, of course, that normal is only a setting on a dryer. Now, if Sparky is up for it, we will do a Thanksgiving on the front porch Thursday evening, and then Friday evening, depending on how things play out, I'll either be filling in for Malloy after 2 hours of this program, or Malloy will be back, and we'll have a Friday on the front porch, too. There's really no other way to plan than that. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and I hope Thanksgiving week is wonderful for everyone and that you do whatever your Thanksgiving traditions are, not least of which might be remembering that it's a complicated holiday. It's all wrapped up in white folks massacring indigenous people and a nasty little myth that we tell our children as they're turning their outstretched hands, tracing them on paper and turning them into turkeys in elementary school about Squanto and teaching the clueless white folks how not to starve to death. And then there's, along the way, the Civil War, which is when the idea of a day of national Thanksgiving really kind of caught on. Now, every program here begins with thanks, and this program is no different. And so thanks go out to our subscribers over the weekend. And that would be to Stacy and Bernice, to our friend at Mellow Moonlit Meadow, to Philip in Maryland, to Josh and Samson and James and Pamela in Washington, to Kay and Mark, and James, Jim, in Spain. And I have happy news. We are done with fundraising, so there will be no further fundraising. We've got fundraising-free radio through the remainder of the month, a whole week of it, and how wonderful is that? And that's in large part due to Tom. Thank you, Tom. And thank you to Shorty in L.A. And thank you to Charlene in Rogues Island. And thanks, of course, to our anonymous friend who posed the challenge in the first place. But we're done. We are done with fundraising for the month of November, and there will be not another, except for the thank yous, there will be not another word said about it for the remainder of the month. Isn't that wonderful? It thrills me to pieces. Sorry, just had to connect the little gizmo to the Progressive Voices doohickey. And that's all good for here about 3 hours from now. Good deal. Let's see. It's Moran Monday. It's so very Moran Monday. And I've got a couple of things, but just a little. You know, when we were talking on Friday, I mentioned the fact that I had had a cortisone injection into my hand to deal with the trigger finger. And it hurt more. And I said back then, it hurts more now than before I got the injection. Well, I've done what the doctor told me to do, and I've soaked it. I soaked my hand in Epsom salts. I probably should have soaked my head, too. And I've continuously massaged it. And guess what? It appears the trigger finger is almost gone. How cool is that? But something else came to light in that process. And so I mentioned this to you primarily as a caveat or not really a warning. It's not like there's any danger involved. But just to sort of, you know, if I sound a little weird, if I sound maybe a little bit more peppy than usual, well, I went through the weekend with phenomenal energy. And only today, and my blood pressure went up a little bit, you know, and I found myself being perhaps a little short in my responses. Didn't feel like eating a whole lot, and then all of a sudden I would. And Agnes and I were talking just a little bit ago, and she said, Bob, might be the cortisone. I said, yeah, but it was just a shot into my... She said, how much? I said, you know, it looked like about an inch and a half in the syringe. She said, that's enough. She's a nurse, you know. And so if I'm a little bit... If I'm a bubble off plum this evening or... letting go now, letting go now. Letting everything go. Yes. But remember me, I'm the guy who can't tolerate caffeine. And so cortisone is probably double or triple that. Wowzer. And I feel a little, scatterbrained. And that's a whole lot to pin on one lousy little cortisone injection. But according to Nurse Agnes, it is not entirely outside the realm of possibility that it is a fact. So, who knew? But it's great. I mean, there's still some soreness. But it's great to just move my left hand and have all my fingers moving at the same time, the same way, without that hitch, click, click, click. It's wonderful. It's exquisite. And it's something, and it's relief from something that's been going on for, God, 12 years? Yeah, 12 years. And I finally said, yeah, just hit right. So, but if I get a little strange, yeah. How are we ever going to tell, Bob? I know. Oh, well, Jack in Shreveport says, this may be the first time I've been able to tell a difference in the well howdy from that of other programs. Well, that's because there's a little bit of technical tweaking and so forth going on here, trying to make things sound a little bit better than they ordinarily have. And I kind of like it, too. Oh, and thanks. Thanks very kindly. Thank you very kindly to James in Illinois, Done fundraising? Not yet, grasshopper. Snatch the pebble from my hand, because now I have had a cortisone injection, and I can close my hand before you can snatch the pebble. Oh, the pebble is gone. Time for you to go. Mm-hmm. Thank you, James. Thank you very much indeed. Brother Deacon Asa lets us know, hot on both streams aboard the Moran Brain Train. Show of hands, Horn Family Community Congregation. Who'll be surprised should the ousted former Marine Captain Richard Spencer be replaced with basement-dwelling, low-life, white supremacist Richard Spencer as the Secretary of the Navy? I confess I wasn't aware that Richard Spencer was the Secretary of the Navy, and the first time I heard his name over the course of this, well, as bizarre as any other, and possibly more so, weekend, because remember, however weird the previous weekend was, then this was weirder, and however weird this one was, the next one's going to be weirder still. Kind of a harrowing thought. But when I first heard the name Secretary of the Navy Richard Spencer, I did one of those W.C. Fields triple takes and said, no, they didn't. Well, it's a totally different Richard Spencer. And he's not Secretary of the Navy anymore. Because he stood up to the punk POTUS. Ooh, is that a new thing? Punk POTUS? And I've got his letter here, and we can talk about that here in a little bit. Big breaking news here at about airtime. The White House will surely appeal, and I know, don't call you Shirley. The White House will certainly appeal the ruling that just came down today. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia rejected, shot down, slammed the MAGAT administration's plea and claim that Don McGahn should not have to testify before impeachment investigators. In fact, he said, gotta go. And the nature of the claim was one of absolute immunity, not qualified immunity, absolute immunity, which is kind of important because that means wholly and entirely above the law. Which, of course, is exactly how Nitwit Nero views himself. That claim has now been rejected by an Article III Senate-confirmed, presidentially appointed United States District Judge. Because they had claimed absolute immunity for anyone who served in the president's administration. So the Justice Department, which shouldn't, but is instead run by a lawless pettifogger by the name of Bill Barr to prosecution, the Justice Department should not appeal this case, but should instead recognize that it is a matter of settled law that should never have even been before a judge in the first place, but they're gonna. The United States Department of Justice will appeal this to the D.C. Circuit, and it'll go from the D.C. Circuit up to, well, you know the bunch, old Balls and Strikes Roberts and Clarence Pubes on the Coke Can Slappy Thomas and Sammy shoot him in the back of the head even though they're running away and they're unarmed at 30 yards as long as they're not white. Alito, Sammy Bad Breath Alito. And Ann's boy, Neil. And, of course, Brat Kavanaugh, who likes beer. If they wish to preserve the legal status quo and maintain some tattered form of the existence of the idea of stare decisis, that old Balls and Strikes Roberts is going to have to side with RBG and Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor and Oh, the guy whose name I have such a hard time remembering. David Souter. Or they could just refuse to hear it, and that might be the easiest course of action. Because old Balls and Strikes Roberts hates to have to vote against his fellow white-wing ideologues. On the other hand, there's Don McGahn's lawyer, William A. Burke. And they're trying to be sort of Switzerland in this and saying, hey, you know, this is a thing between the Congress and the president and the courts. I mean, we got nothing in it. When, in fact, Don McGahn is up to his eyeballs. But William A. Burke said, Don McGahn will comply with Judge Jackson's decision unless it is stayed pending appeal. The DOJ is handling this case, so you will need to ask them whether they intend to seek a stay. Well, thanks. Thanks for that, Lawyer Burke. We'd never have known otherwise. But this could have a significant this could have a significant impact on a number of subpoenas. For instance, John Bolton. Or Mike Pompeo. Or Rick Goodhair Perry. So, the one thing the folks at the New York Times are saying is that there appears to be little chance that the matter will be resolved in time for Mr. McGahn's potential testimony to play any role in the impeachment inquiry. Well, somebody in the for-profit media decided to check in with Adam Schiff over the weekend, and he said, look, we can come back and take more testimony. There's no reason we can't. But just to give you an idea of how long it takes for this kind of stuff to grind through the process, the subpoena was served on Don McGahn last May. Hell, we hadn't even hit the first day of summer. The days were still getting both longer and warmer and more beautiful. And now we're staring at gray and leaden skies and snow crossing the continent. Because that's the way the judicial system crawls. And that and when you've got a bad faith administration, those crawling schedules always inure to its benefit. And since then, of course, we've got the issue of the Trump regime flatly saying that they will violate every known and accepted principle of law until they are told, forced to do otherwise. Now, you know, Clarity, I think we need you to sing that. Because it's not right there in my old DJ brain. Everybody do the perp walk. Yeah, yeah, the perp walk. Rufus Thomas lives. Thank you, Clarity. So we've got ever so many things to deal with this evening. What did I say, Ralphs? Ralph says, oh, my God, don't say that, Bob. As soon as I figure out what it was, I won't. Jim reminding us all, cortisone can play with your temperament. And I think it did. I think it did. And I'm going to try not to go into any screaming polemics or jeremiads or anything like that over the course of the evening. Nice, even keel. Right. Sure. But it is Moran Monday, and there's really no getting around that. And that means that we're going to have to do, we're going to have to deal with some Moran stuff. Sweet fake baby Jeebus, help us. And so we shall. I had a note earlier today from our buddy Johan on the Colorado Front Range. And he sent along an opinion piece from, the National Review. And in his note, Johan said, perhaps an on-air exploration, and the reason I'm dealing with this is because of the Don McGahn story and the anticipated action by the Supreme Court. Perhaps an on-air exploration and discussion with Dr. Bill or informed others as to the merits of this. Sorry, front porchers, but this ain't about the cats either. I never thought I'd be walking through the same neighborhood as the National Review, but I have been and continue to be very worried about the outcome of future presidential elections. I share your disgust over the very existence of the Electoral College and of virtually everything else relating to the entire federal judicial system, given the current regime's threats to reason and to any hope for some semblance of justice in this country. Obviously, an institution of term limits for Supreme Court justices, for that's what the National Review article is about, would not help with the present day and near future disaster that is or will be the composition of the highest bench. But if this could be instituted soon enough, whatever that might be, could we avoid some of the worst that the Federalist Society and other right-wing bastards have planned for us? In any event, I think the subject deserves our attention. And signed, Johan on the Colorado Front Range. And I share what our buddy Johan wrote, because I also share much of the philosophy involved with it. Now, John Fund wrote this thing over at the National Review, and we must remember, and I'm not trying to destroy the argument by resort to an ad hominem attack against that publication, but you cannot ignore the history of that publication. The National Review has long been a clearinghouse for various and sundry bigotries, right-wing sympathies, and outright white supremacy and racism. That having been said, this is an article about the potential for term limits on the Supreme Court, and it highlights a group called Fix the Court, which claims to have a bipartisan proposal. And any time a Republican publication starts talking about something being bipartisan, well, you better count the silver and lock the China cabinet. Because it generally means that a bunch of right-wing Republicans have found a Zell Miller or a Holy Joe Lieberman or someone of that ilk to play footsie with. But the problem of lifetime tenure on the Supreme Court, well, we have to decide first, is it a problem? And it's hard not to reach the realization that the answer is probably yes. Yes, it is. Because if you take a long view of the history of the Supreme Court, they have gotten as much wrong and arguably more wrong than they have ever gotten right. And we've been through this shameful list in the past, of course. You've got Dred Scott, the Slaughterhouse cases, Plessy versus Ferguson, Schenck, Froework, and Debs, the New York bakery case that struck down New York's early attempt to regulate workplace, workplace safety. And onward down through the, down through the ages. Up to and including Bush v. Gore and Citizens United. The question is, can you blame that on lifetime tenure? And John Fund, the author of the piece, points out the fact that we on this side of the political spectrum are sweating bullets, and those of us who pray are praying multiple times daily for the successful or the continued decent health and just general being aliveness of not only Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but the other three members of the liberal, so-called liberal wing of the court. Because if a vacancy opens on the court, which is another way of saying if somebody dies or retires, you can retire, then we know how Moscow Mitch will behave. All those excuses for why he would not give a hearing to Merrick Garland will be out the window, because the president is no longer, 3/5 of a president. Remember, Moscow Mitch was born not in Kentucky, but a little further south in a state that refers to itself as the Heart of Dixie. And I'm talking about the same part of Alabama where I was born, the Shoals. And Moscow Mitch was born in Sheffield. So, by way of looking at this, as I read through this piece from National Review, I confess I did so with more than a little bit of skepticism, because it's in the Constitution that they serve for life on good behavior, and that's taken as meaning that they are appointed the Supreme Court justices and Article III judges, in general, for life on good behavior. And that they can only be removed from the bench upon impeachment based upon their bad behavior, as demonstrated before the House of Representatives, charged by the House of Representatives and tried by the Senate. Lochner. Thank you, Stephen, New York. Lochner is the bakery case. That's the golden age of employment law that Republicans would love to return to. Lochner. I need to do something about the brain cell that Lochner was on. It's laying down on the job. But according to John Fund, this outfit, this bipartisan outfit called Fix the Court, has come up with a bipartisan proposal for 18-year term limits for the Supreme Court. A vacancy would come up every 2 years, meaning that every president would have at least two appointments in each term. And they claim that you could do this without without violating the Constitution by making every departing Supreme Court justice serve on the United States Circuit Court of Appeals. I guess for life down there. And this is it's a novel argument, but a sketchy one. And the question is, what is there to make us think that a Senate that still has to confirm justices, say, run by a Moscow Mitch or one of his progeny, wouldn't just Merrick Garland everything that a Democratic president did, leave the seats open and wait for a Republican, and then, hey, look. Because the only way to compel the Senate Majority Leader to do otherwise would be to amend the Constitution, and not just Article 3. But there are a couple of other things that made me want to take a look, a deeper look at this article, because it's more in Monday. And forgive me, I got a sneaking suspicion John Fund is, in fact, a moron. Because he writes things like this. Now, Supreme Court justices can spend two generations on the bench, and so long as they avoid impeachment, only they can decide when it's time to leave. Judges today usually retire only when they can ensure a philosophically compatible successor. This can result in judges staying past their, and he puts scare quotes around it, sell-by date, either physically or mentally. Examples in the past 50 years include Justices William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall. Now, okay, you're busy, and you read the article. It was republished at Yahoo News, and you breeze through, and you don't think about that reference to William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, and you just cruise on through. Well, you know, he's probably got an argument there. I mean, he's got a point. Judges stay too long on. It is not a coincidence that a clearinghouse for so-called conservatism and actual white supremacy, like the National Review, that someone writing for them would include Thurgood Marshall as a person who stayed too long on the court. Recall, please, that Thurgood Marshall was instrumental in making the arguments that led to the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown versus Board of Education. He was then appointed to the Supreme Court as the first African-American justice thereon. And he had health problems. But that is not, that's not a disqualifier. Jesus, Richard M. Nixon hated Thurgood Marshall's guts. Oh, he wanted him off the court. Oh, he wanted to replace him. And I think it's in Woodward and Bernstein's book, The Brethren, an anecdote about one of those instances where Thurgood Marshall was ill, and he was in the hospital in Washington, D.C., and Nixon actually posted a couple of minions outside of his door. And one day, Thurgood Marshall called one of the minions in and handed him a note that he had written and sealed and directed to to Richard Milhouse Pinhead Nixon. Now, I don't think he used pinhead. He probably used all the proper obsequies and courtesies. President Richard M. Nixon. But when Nixon got it at the White House and opened it, it was only two words. Not yet. And William O. Douglas? If I recall correctly, William O. Douglas was actually a Republican, maybe a governor. Correct me if I'm wrong, Horn Research, Ad Hoc Research Department. But he didn't stay past his sell-by date because the Constitution doesn't have one. And this paragraph is interesting, the way that the space between the notes in music is music, too. He chooses Justice William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, two Supreme Court justices who wrote opinions that folks there at the National Review didn't much cotton to, if you know what I mean. You know who he leaves off the overstayed his welcome, stayed longer than his sell-by date? You know who he leaves off of that list? William H. Rehnquist. William H. Rehnquist was appointed by Nixon and elevated to the chief justiceship by, wasn't it Ronnie Reagan? But here's one of the things that we only found out way too late. And you can't say this about Douglas or Thurgood Marshall. William H. Rehnquist. Well, you know, we are in the throes of an opioid crisis. And it's interesting because Ron and Raleigh just wrote to me about the very same thing. And not a mumbling word about William Rehnquist. You know, we are in the midst of an opioid crisis in this country. But long before there was an opioid crisis in this country, William Rehnquist was whacked out of his ever-loving mind on narcotic painkillers. And, you know, anybody who ever listened, say, to Flush Flimball, the oxymoron, back when he was really deep into the junk, back when he was putting $10,000 in a cigar box and handing it to his housekeeper and having her go out and come back with $10,000 worth of street OxyContin so he could chew them up for the refreshing burst of flavor. Anybody who ever listened to him and listened to just how insane he was . Well, you know that stuff alters your thought patterns. And so we really don't have any way of knowing how many lives were forever altered because the Supreme Court Chief Justice was half out of his mind on dope. But somehow or another, that escapes the attention of John Fund at the National Review. As Ron and Raleigh points out, Rehnquist was high on painkillers these last few years on the bench. The man looked like the walking dead. And, you know, not in a good way. But But that wasn't the only thing in the article that I found interesting. You know, by the way, I'm getting some grief from Flavio over my cortisone injection. Flavio says, cortisone shot. Hypochondriac, Annie? Jesus, Bob, you're not going to get roid rage from a friggin' cortisone shot. You're not juicing, LOL. Look, I'm the guy who goes to sleep walking past the Benadryl in the cut rate pharmacy, and gets all, and I get the caffeine jitters just walking into Starbucks. I'm sensitive to these kinds of things. I'm a sensitive guy. And just looking back over the last few days, I mean, you don't put that stuff in there and it doesn't have any impact. I'm just saying. But anyway, going back to John Fund's article, he's got another paragraph that leapt off the page at me. When he's talking about life tenure on the court. Before he mentions Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, he says, the time has come to remove the incentives that make justices serve until they drop dead or are gaga. It's time to put term limits on the Supreme Court. Gaga. You know, it's funny. There have been justices who retired, and they certainly were not gaga. I guess that's a complicated legal term from the highfalutin multimillionaire members of the media who write pieces like this for the National Review. Gaga. Well, he delves into the idea of lifetime tenure. And he says, and this is one of those moments where you realize that, well, John Fund's out there and he moves and he swans around among the people who have, who know which fork to use with the shrimp and which fork to use with the oysters, and know to never dig into the Ocetra caviar with a plain old metal spoon, that you have to use one made with a tiny little spoon made of mother of pearl. Godfrey Daniel, mother of pearl. And so he doesn't really realize what's happening out here in Merca. Because he writes, our founding fathers granted life tenure to Supreme Court justices to ensure their independence. But that's a relic of a day when the average life expectancy was 38. Today it is more than twice that. Well, Mr. Fund, I wonder if he would care to guess why the life expectancy in 1787 was 38. I mean, just a guess. I mean, I got two right off the top of my head that could affect that number. But you'd actually have to care to even know. One of them, and maybe it leapt off the page at me because of what I've been reading of late, that book, That History of Dueling. In 1787... and particularly the further south you got, fathers actually raised sons in the deep south and told them about how dear and precious was their honor, and not to allow anybody to ever besmirch it. And if and they did, they taught them how to issue a challenge to a potential duel to the death. Boys as young as 14 years old were fighting duels in the earliest days of this country. and thousands died. And they were generally, you know, young men are hot-tempered, and Southerners are more hot-tempered than Northerners. But they died in their thousands. And it was usually young men up to middle age. Very seldom did you have the septuagenarians and octogenarians out there blazing away at one another. One presumes by then that they'd learned a little bit of sense. But the other thing, and this is far more important than, say, deaths from gunplay, the other thing that drives that life expectancy down, I mean, there are a number. Philadelphia was periodically hammered by plague. We have an August recess in Washington, D.C., because you had to get out of town before the yellow fever and the malaria could kill you. So, disease. But one more thing. Childbirth. Infant mortality and postpartum mortality make that number as brutally low as it is. And in almost all the categories, all the statistical categories, that number is significantly higher. That life expectancy number is significantly higher. For who? Well, it's the same as it is today. For the wealth class. For the wealth class. And so John Fund's argument that, well, you know, we can have 18-year terms for the Supreme Court now because everybody's living longer. Back then, the average life expectancy was 38. Today, it is more than twice that. But nobody's told John Fund at any of his well-heeled cocktail parties that here in Appalachia and throughout rural America, particularly the rural South, and particularly among the poor, that for the first time in decades, life expectancy, male and female, is in decline. I guess John Fund has never had any occasion to be in a place like McDowell County, West Virginia, where the life expectancy for a man is less than it is for someone for a similarly situated man in Guatemala, where the life expectancy for a man is only slightly better than it is for a man in Haiti, and where that life expectancy ain't anywhere near 2 times 38. But this isn't an America for those people anyway, if you're John Fund. The racists and the bigots and the xenophobes and the economic and social conservatives over at the National Review, well, this is their America. And they're going to live to be 100. Because they don't have to sweat things like choosing between eating some months and having life-preserving or saving medication. John Fund has never tried to stretch his insulin over the course of a month by doing half-dosing or skipping doses because insulin has become so goddamned expensive. John Fund never does that. And so while the Supreme Court is deeply frustrating, and hey, I got another Supreme Court case, a Supreme Court story right behind this one. They were busy today. I don't know, and pursuant to the request that Johan put forward, term limits generally get my hackles up, wherever my hackles are. And they give me the creeps, because anytime you put forward some scheme other than what is in the Constitution, you may be guaranteed, at least here in this penultimate year of the second decade of the 21st century, that it will be positively poison with politics. And he tries to make the idea of term limits for Supreme Court justices a selling point by pointing out that we also have term limits for the president. And some people, like Tom Steyer, Jesus Christ, are still out there talking about, we need congressional term limits. Two of the most anti-democratic things imaginable. Because we do realize that in an elected situation, and we're talking about appointments with the Supreme Court, but in an elected situation, we do realize that when we talk about term limits, we're talking about disenfranchising voters. Yeah, but I got a great congressman. I want to keep him. I want to keep her. Well, I'm sorry, voter. You don't get to vote for her again because we've arbitrarily decided that she's been there too long. Your judgment is no good. Your opinion doesn't matter. See how it works? Sure. But lo and behold, he cites a 2018 poll that says that 61% of registered voters favor Supreme Court term limits. Sadly, that was 67% of Democrats and 58% of Republicans. You know what? If the people of the United States elected better presidents, we wouldn't be having this conversation. If the people of the United States had not put old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan, in office, we wouldn't have had Sandra Day O'Connor sitting there casting the deciding vote in Bush versus fucking Gore. But she did. And look at where we are. It's kind of like something that Reverbo wrote to me a few days ago. He said, and this had to do with November the 22nd. He sent it the following day, Saturday. Another anniversary of JFK assassination. How different history would have been shaped. How much of our situation today connects to that day 56 years ago. That and the Beatles changed the world. And Lennon gets killed too. Consider this. That bullet misses JFK, then Bobby succeeds his brother, no Nixon, no Reagan, no Bush. All the things that made it suck don't happen. Yeah. Profound, isn't it? And then he bolsters his argument, John Fund does, with a quote from who? The problem, the Federalist Society. The abundance of judges who do not view themselves as limited by constitutional or statutory text also drives the politicization of the confirmation process. By adding to the content of laws, they are acting as politicians rather than judges and should expect a political selection process to match. Oh, fuck right off. The last I checked, the biggest political ideologues who have a proclivity for overriding legislative will. Well, they just happen to be Ann's boy, Neil, and Brett Kavanaugh. So, while we can, and I know I do, get puking sick of the Supreme Court, I get sick of it because the people who are on it make sickening decisions. I get sick of the Supreme Court because the people who pick the Supreme Court justices have no business doing that. And the people who have no business choosing Supreme Court justices become president of the United States because the people of the United States, A, mostly or very nearly mostly, don't fucking vote. And B, when they do, they vote on issues like, well, is he a Christian? I need somebody what's got a Christian respect for life. Oh, sure, George W. Bush, go ahead. Murder a million innocent Iraqi civilians. But you're a Christian, right? You just sent them all. No, they went to hell, didn't they? Ooh, that's a problem. So the answer isn't term limits. The answer is a better civics. A better understanding of who and how we are as a nation. And if we survive, we will get there. I remain firmly convinced of it. Because this is a changing country, no matter how many good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual, Christian Republicans run out into the surf and demand that the tide not come in. And a plan like this, well, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And yeah, John Fund gives me the creeping horrors. Ron and Raleigh with a note. I have a question. How do you know about caviar spoons? Your secret elitism is showing through. Well, that's the thing. You couldn't give me a tin of caviar for free. I'm sorry, I am. But if you watch enough hoity-toity food programs, sooner or later they will tell you that you have to have a mother-of-pearl spoon to eat your fucking Ocetra caviar. Me, I'm still with Tom Hanks's character from Big. Remember, he's all grown up, and he goes to the cocktail party, and he tries a little caviar, and he goes, nah, nah, nah. And, you know, he's sticking his tongue out, nah. Yeah, not so much of a caviar guy. But trust me, Ron. It is strictly a matter of too much TV viewing. Probably Bourdain somewhere along the way, if you want to get right down to it. Point of order, says Steve in New York. What would be a person looking like The Walking Dead in a good way? Well, you know, the TV show. Emmys. Endorsement deals. Commercials. Contracts. Next thing you know, you got a home in the country and a river of beer flowing over your grandmother's paisley shawl. Now, Jack in Shreveport says as to term limits for SCOTUS, anything other than life terms leaves a justice jockeying for another job afterwards. So the justice would probably be beholden to somebody somewhere. You know, just like lifetime appointed Brett Kavanaugh is beholden to whoever that mysterious soul was who paid off all of his baseball tickets and all of his debts and left him living in a house free and clear when there was no way he possibly ever could have done that. And going back to some early constitutional principles, Ron in Raleigh says, hey, tell me something. Wasn't a swift and speedy trial one of the central tenets of our justice system? What the hell's happened? These black-robed politicians don't have anything else to do but rule on matters before them. They need to go off their dead judicial asses and earn their fucking salaries. See, that's easy to say. But it takes as long as it does, not because they're all the judges are sitting around playing a friendly rubber of whist. Does whist come in rubbers? I probably should not have said come in rubbers, should I? Well, we made it through an hour of the program before I ruined dinner in the central time zone. My apologies. It's strictly a matter of the schedule, because the idea of a fair and impartial judiciary requires that no one get special advantage. So you serve the complaint, you get 20 days to answer. You can file a notice and get an extra 10. Then the answer comes in, and then you move into discovery or motion practice, and everything gets a brief. And the movant, the person making the motion, has a certain amount of time to file the brief. And then the person responding to the brief, the party responding to the brief, has another equal amount of time to respond to the brief. And then the person who made the motion in the first place has a chance to rebut the brief, to rebut the response. And at about a month apiece, bang, you're in November from a subpoena served in May. And that's how the system operates. But I said I had another Supreme Court case, because this being Moran Monday, you can't go wrong dealing with the old balls and strikes court as a potential nominee. So you may recall that the Circuit Court of Appeals, the D.C. Circuit, upheld the subpoena by members of the House of Representatives of the accounting firm Mazars. Well, they subpoenaed Mazars for Nitwit Nero's tax records. And settled law says, well, turn them over. Now, they didn't subpoena Nitwit Nero. He's not a party to the case. The Trump Organization is not a party to the case. It is merely a congressional subpoena served upon an accounting firm. But Nitwit Nero and his grifty, greasy, skeevy family business intervened. Well, the federal district court said, nope, sorry, you lose.
So much losing.
And then the D.C. Circuit, by a 2-1 vote, upheld the district court. The one judge who voted against upholding the subpoena just happened to be a circuit court judge appointed by Nitwit Nero, who shouldn't even have been hearing the case, but should have recused themselves because they were ruling on a case involving the person they owed for their fucking job. So that's two losses for Nitwit Nero. Then he went and asked the D.C. Circuit to haul out every judge on the circuit and have them rehear that case, and they said, nope. Well, that sent the case to the to the house that's run by old Balls and Strikes Roberts. And so today, the Supreme Court granted Nitwit Nero's request for an emergency stay blocking the subpoena for the financial records from Mazars. How about that? The simplest thing The simplest thing would have been to say, nope, not a leg to stand on. You're not going to get cert on this, and you're certainly never going to win because this violates every principle of stare decisis that I, John Roberts, said I would uphold when I was under oath in front of the Senate of the United States and swore that I was only there to call balls and strikes, and hence my nickname, Old Balls and Strikes Roberts. That ain't necessarily a good thing. But you've got enough maggots on the court to at least delay this case a little longer, because now that we're into the process, the Republicans all want it to go on as long as possible. Now they want it to stretch into the election year. Used to be they wanted it over before Thanksgiving, but now they see a political value in having it drag out. And so with an eye toward the National Review article there by John Fund, let's see. Well, John Roberts wouldn't be off the bench. Sammy Bad Breath wouldn't be off the bench. Ann's boy Neil wouldn't be off the bench under those 18-year term limits. Brat Kavanaugh wouldn't be off the bench. He'd still just be there drinking beer in the house somebody paid for that we don't know who. Souter and Ginsburg would probably be cashiered as a result of that plan. And that just would have resulted in another couple of hard right-wing racist ideologues going onto the court. You see how something that seems like at first blush it might be a reasonable idea suddenly becomes not at all when you watch it and operate as a Republican would intend for it to operate? Yeah. So now we'll. I don't know. Maybe we can all go to the mall. You know, if Roy Tolamore isn't creepering on Santa's little helper, and get up on Santa's lap and ask him for a Supreme Court ruling for impeachment. Yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath. Note coming in from Steve in New York, but remember this, speedy trial only applies to criminal cases. That's true. I meant to mention that, Steve, but doesn't apply to civil cases. Often, as I recall, my criminal procedure professor saying, sometimes a criminal defendant doesn't want a speedy trial. Sometimes it's the last thing in the world a criminal defendant wants. But if you move on, then the definition kicks in, and that's usually within a term or so, a term of the court. Oh, yeah, and when we're thinking about horrible Supreme Court decisions, as Steve reminds us, can't forget Hobby Lobby, super dumb case where a company has religious beliefs. Doesn't come much dumber than that. Oh, no. Subject line demanding that the tide no longer not come in. Lee in New York says, what bothers me most are the people who watch the ruler demand the tide not come in, and then they're ankle deep in water when they were just standing on sand and proclaim, look, the ruler stopped the tide from coming in. We're doomed. Yeah, or the ones who think, you know what? Other people probably couldn't do it, but he's making the seashore great again. Right. Uh-oh. I'm in trouble with Brother Deacon Asa again. Friend, I had to pull over to type this, so you know it's important to me. Your foodie card. Your foodie card has been revoked. Shit, not even suspended. Has been revoked until such time as you repent for those hateful statements you made about caviar. Jesus, jumping Christ. And here I was, seeking foodie advice from you for all these years. Next thing you'll tell me is you put ketchup on your well-done steak. Watch your mouth, mister. Is it possible you haven't had the right kind of caviar? I suppose it's possible. If there's a caviar out there that isn't fish eggs. If there's a caviar out there that doesn't taste fish-y. That's the best I got. I'm not a real big fishy fish fan. I'm not an oily fish fan. And the only caviar I've ever had kind of, left me cold. But listen, I love truffles. And not even the chocolate kind, the kind the pigs look for. I love truffles. And oysters. And yes, I even like uni. Sea urchin roe. You know what I think gets me about caviar? It's the texture. And the taste like fish part. I mean, I like fish. But not bait fish. But the other thing I really don't like, And I think it started in Asia, and then it made its way here, and it's all the rage. And so, you've heard, you know what bubble tea is? It's the sweet tea kind of concoction with fruit flavors and stuff, and great big pearl tapioca in it. I can't abide tapioca. As my mother once said, when I asked, I was a little kid, and I said, what is it? She said, I'll fix you some. Because she wasn't gonna bias me. Made me some tapioca. I tried it. Chewed. You know, you really shouldn't have to chew pudding. But I chewed. And I didn't like. And I said, well, I like it. She said, and then she said, I didn't think you would. It always reminded me of frog's eggs. Don't ask me how my wonderful, beloved, long since gone hillbilly mama knew what frog's eggs were like. That's just how these things go sometimes. Subject line, Citizens United. David in South Carolina stands says, hey, remember when Barack Obama stated that Citizens United would lead to foreign governments being involved in the U.S. elections? And remember how Sammy Bad Breath Alito sat there during the State of the Union and shook his head no? And now we're up to our eyeballs in foreign involvement in American elections precisely because of the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United? Yeah, yeah, David, I remember that. Good times. Shaking his head no. That was the same year, wasn't it, that Joe, whose name isn't Joe Wilson, yelled, "You lie," from the House floor. As to term limits, Ron in Raleigh says, people are stupid. They don't seem to realize that a term-limited judge or politician can take advice from whoever's paying their bills. Just do what we want you to do for your term, and then we'll set you up with a real cushy gig. Great work if you can get it. Oh, and this showed up at Salon by Paul Rosenberg. And I really, but it's more Ann Monday, and hence the nomination. I really didn't spend a lot of time, I didn't spend nearly as much time with it as I did the National Review story. The headline reads, "How the GOP became the parties of crook, how the GOP became the party of crooks and crime." And I saw that headline, and I knew that the headline alone was worthy of a nomination this evening. Mr. Rosenberg begins by saying, "Whatever happened to the Republicans as the party of law and order? True, Richard Nixon, who first branded the party that way, was lying when he famously said, 'I'm not a crook.'" And then he goes on from there. But when I saw that headline, "How the GOP became the party of crooks and crime," I wondered to myself, well, when did that becoming take place? Because it seems like they've been the party of crooks and crime for a terribly long time. I wasn't quite 10 years old when Nixon's henchmen did their dirty business. And then came Iran-Contra. The Reagan administration was the single most corrupt presidential administration until we got to W. And then W had to take a bow once Nitwit Nero got hold of the reins of power, and he's not even been in for 3 full years, and he's already left Reagan and Nixon combined in his dust. Yeah, but Bob, I mean, that was 19... You weren't quite 10. Okay, groovy. Teapot Dome, anybody? Bueller? I mean, that was Republicans selling the country by the barrel. Well, okay, I mean, but that, no, it wasn't limited. How about the administration of Ulysses Grant? And then there's the essential corruption of Andrew Johnson. And by the way, not to be contrarian, but the fact of the matter is, well, even Lincoln himself had some corruption problems. There is an argument to be made that had the Civil War been put to rest, and Lincoln served out his second term, which he had won in 1864. Well, he might have been America's first 3-term president. because April in Washington, D.C. in 1865 is another one of those moments, one of those hinges upon which the future of this country turned. But it's also possible that Lincoln might have been impeached for the actions of his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln. If you read any serious biography of Abraham Lincoln, you will find that she spent money that had not been appropriated. She indebted the executive branch, spending on curtains and rugs and furniture and God knows her wardrobe, to the point that even Lincoln's Republican allies were pulling him aside and saying, Abe, this shit ain't constitutional. So the question of how the GOP became the party of crooks and crime is a question that, well, it's a distinction without a difference. That at some point in time there was some honest GOP. There never has been. And I hope we can... at least just acknowledge the reality of history. Subject line, truffle oil. We're back into the food porn. Steve in New York says, my former roommate would make potato latkes around Hanukkah. He'd brush them with truffle oil. Oh, man, I never knew potato cakes could be so good. Well, potato cakes are heaven on earth to begin with. Truffle oil? Oh, get out of town. Now you've started something. And I don't need to be salivating on the air. Ron in Raleigh says, I remember a country comedian went to a fancy gala and the host served him caviar. After eating a cracker full of the best beluga caviar, the comedian whispered to his host, I think your huckleberry jam's gone bad. I think it was Jerry Clower. I'm almost certain it was Jerry Clower. It had to be. Yeah, that's like the other old boy that says, you know, I had some toast this morning with your Kentucky jelly on it, but it really didn't have much flavor. Kentucky jelly? Yeah. As for the corruption of the GOP, David in South Carolina Stan says it was the Southern strategy that kicked off the GOP crime wave in the modern era. Yeah, and it was money, too. The unending desire among Republicans for more of, you know, our money to be transferred to them. Silent R. Lamar is trying to get something going. May I start some shit, please? What's wrong with ketchup on steak? Silent R. Lamar, brother. I can't. It's just wrong. But then again, I feel that way generally about ketchup all the way around. Ferg got me started on that, ordering hamburgers without ketchup. I can't abide the taste of it anymore. But on a good steak, really? Oh, Silent R, please tell me you don't upend the Heinz bottle on a piece of prime rib. Please. Don't hurt me that way. Subject line, caviar. Jack in Shreveport says, what's with all the talk about caviar all of a sudden? Don't y'all know the finest caviar is Russian caviar? Commies! Yeah, but now some of the finest caviar is coming from a sturgeon farm in Florida. No kidding. Yeah, thanks, Steve. I had the McGann story almost at the beginning of the program. That's what occasioned the further diversion into the Supreme Court. Oh, truffle butter? Yeah, Jim. Yeah, that, That's a religious experience. So here, well, like I said, truncated program this evening, only 2 hours. But by all means, go over to Progressive Voices come 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, and we'll do hour three on the Malloy program. Let's see what Todd's got going on. Hey, Todd.
Oh, I didn't know you were doing a truncated program tonight.
Yeah, they all are this week, except for Thursday evening is going to be Thanksgiving on the front porch.
Okay. Well, my God, you're on fire, man. You just hit on so many things with food and the politics. And let me cut this radio off real quick. But, yo, God dog it, man. I'm telling you, mushroom soup is no joke. The truffles, it's good soup.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
And, you know, today was Trader Joe's Day, so I just got back from there not long ago.
Well, did they have, Tracy's going to want to know, do they still have the pumpkin ice cream at your Trader Joe's?
They probably do. They had pumpkin everything else. I mean, yeah, I would say yes. I didn't see it, but I would say yes. If I had to bet, yeah, I would say yes. Because they had the pumpkin spice everywhere. They had, you know, they changed the store around for the holidays.
Okay, Silent R. Lamar has restored my faith in him. No, Bob, I do not use ketchup on steak. Sometimes on fries. Well, on fries, yeah. I mean,
See, I got to start from the end and work back. Okay, because you know it's so sad. Many of us, you know, we don't appreciate ketchup and excuse me, I sneeze.
Bless you.
Excuse me. Oh, that was great. All right, ketchup and soy sauce, you know, because they are condiments that should be used sparingly. They're wonderful when used sparingly. However, many of us that, you know, grew up in a certain time, we just plop down a whole goddamn plate of ketchup and it just ruined the whole goddamn party.
Yeah, you can say the same for Worcestershire, too.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Because you had to correct, I forget the name, what you called it, when we were talking about a steak, like when you finish off a steak, just at less than, like a teaspoon or less, being a teaspoon for a large steak, when it's still sizzling, I mean, it just,
you mean Monto Burro?
Yes, oh my God. And a dab will do you. You see, it's like brew cream. A dab will do you. That's it. That's it. You know, and even a little bit of ketchup. Like when you're, you know, it's like sugar. Like a teaspoon of sugar, and it's a binder. You know, and ketchup has sweeteners in it, so it pulls the flavors together. But you know, you overuse, it's like chemistry. You overuse something, one particular ingredient, it's going to fuck the whole thing up, you know, and you're going to start over. Oh boy. That's just in my experience in kitchen work and cooking and this and that. But, do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay. And I saw that yuzu in there today. Oh, boy, that yuzu's been popular. Yuzu was everywhere. What is up with tapioca? That is some nasty-ass shit.
Okay,
who
just checked. Okay.
Appropriate to eat?
just no.
It's just, it looks like fucking rotten red rice.
I know.
I mean.
Don't care what flavor it is.
It doesn't matter what you flavor it with. It's fucking nasty. It's just like
chewable pudding. No. Meanwhile, Steve passed along a note and said, "Tracy, close your ears. The only way to eat ketchup is mixed with mayonnaise for dipping French fries."
Well,
and the French fries need to be fried in duck fat.
Oh man!
Yeah, that's rich.
Yeah, I'm doing the. I think that the natural cut fries with the skin on the potato, you know, you have to wash them like you're washing a dish, soap and water,
with a vegetable brush.
Right. get in the nooks and crannies. Exactly. See, you know, you get it right. And you know, you fry them in really hot oil so they don't get greasy. You see, the hotter the oil, they don't get greasy. Real hot oil. And then, you let them drain. And then you toss them in a bowl, a nice Pyrex bowl with Parmesan cheese and a little adobo. Oh, shit. Yeah. And people come back. They're like, where's the rest of it? And then we're doing wings tonight.
Oh, nice.
So I got, yeah, so I have different bowls. I have a teriyaki bowl. At the Buffalo Bowl, and what's the other one? I don't know. There's another flavor I'm doing tonight. So you know,
man, I love a spicy, a real hot, spicy, garlicky, lemon pepper wing.
That sounds delicious. You know, speaking of, and this wasn't even on my list, but you know, I'm trying to perfect my version of. I don't even remember the right name for it. But anyway, you flatten out a chicken breast and, you know, you dredge it, you pan fry it. It's Italian. It starts with a C. But it's not lemon pepper, but it's a lemony. And you serve it with pasta and rice. And it's just amazing. And as soon as I hang up, I'll remember what it means.
Oh, naturally. By the way, we're getting pushback on the tapioca, Todd.
What? How?
Billable Rick. Billable Rick. Billable Rick, stop dissing tapioca. It's a dessert with a very unique taste and texture. I like it and don't mind chewing pudding. This coming from a guy who chews his Jell-O.
Well.
How?
Oh.
How do you chew Jell-O?
It's two chomps, chomp, chomp, and swallow.
I mean, you
chomp,
can,
chomp,
you
swallow.
Can, I mean, you can chew a raw oyster, but that doesn't mean you should.
Man, just that, I'm sorry, that whole tapioca thing is just, I was like, oh my God, they tried to feed me that shit when I was little. I was like, ugh. And then when I got older, it reminded me of something else, and I was like, ugh. You know, I was like, no, stay away. You know, no, no, just no. There's too many other things to eat. No, you don't have to eat that. No, you don't have to eat that. I'm thinking about this chicken, though, man. You get, in other words, you get it nice and flat like it's a schnitzel, you know, really flat.
Oh, yeah.
And then you hit it with white wine, make a quick white wine sauce in the same pan with some garlic and lemon and a couple other ingredients and capers. Capers are your key ingredient in this dish. I think it's called, like I said, it starts with a C, but whatever.
Oh, you're talking about you're doing chicken piccata?
Yes. Yes. See, start right. That's the hard consonant. I said it starts with a C. Yes, exactly. Oh, man. I'm perfecting the piccata. Whoa. Man, that shit was. Yo, you will have mugs like they won't want to leave. I'm like, no, you have to go home.
Well, you know, there was a pretty good frozen version of it from a company from Texas called Michelangelo's.
Oh, okay.
And you could microwave it, and it was even decent. But I noticed that it has disappeared from my grocer's frozen case. They got Michelangelo's, a lot of other stuff, but the chicken piccata's gone. I'm bummed.
No, you have to recreate it at home some kind of way. Because you can probably do it on a hot, I mean, I know you can do it on a hot plate, because it's basically a two, you know, you do your pasta or rice or whatever kind of starch you want to have as the heading. So, but doing it as rice, angel hair, and I'm thinking about couscous. I don't know. I'm going to see how it works out with couscous, just to see what happens. You know, see what people, how people react to it.
I love couscous.
Couscous, and it's so quick. My God, all you do is boil the water, and it's done. That's just one side, done, out of the way.
And I'm still a quinoa fan.
Oh, well, now we got that too. I got the tricolor quinoa.
But I bet you didn't really call in for the food porn. Something else was on your mind, wasn't it?
Well, a couple of things. And I'll tell you what piqued my interest is when he started talking about Kavanaugh. Because I don't understand why the press just let all this nonsense with him go. Because, number one, he was out of order when he blew up in his what would be the equivalency of his job interview. He blew up. His desk just disappeared, as you said. And, you know, it's just totally inappropriate. And people act like, well, everything's okay. No, I don't think so. And then I saw a news report real quick, and it went away, where Justice Kennedy met with the current president and pushed Kavanaugh. You know, the whole thing is very shady. This federal society, they're just taking over. This is bullshit. You know, and it's just a very frightening game. You know, they're just going to try to maintain this something, white supremacy, whatever you want to call it. It's not good. And on top of that, we have this criminal ass attorney general now, who I still cannot get over that he had to pause and hesitate when asked about foreign influence. Like, he already knew that was going to come up. You know, he'd already premeditated that this question was going to come up. And that's what I saw. But think about that for a second. But going back to Kavanaugh, and I don't know if you saw the whole hearings. I watched everything. And the ending was very interesting. And even during the whole process of his job interview, well, his wife looked like, I just asked you not to do this. She looks like he looks. I don't know, man. She looks like she's an abused woman to me. And I noticed the body language when they left. He was out. He was out with his daughters, and he just walked right down that hallway with his daughters. Now he left his wife in the dust. He didn't hug his wife. I mean, what the fuck is that? That is not normal behavior. You know, the first thing most people would do is, you know, hold on to your partner, your wife, whatever, and say thank you for supporting me through this. And the kids are behind you. That would be quote unquote normal behavior, in my humble opinion. But that's not what happened. See, she was just like, oh my God, I just can't believe you drug me through this shit. And she looked like a beaten down woman. Now, you know, C-SPAN has the tapes. And you can watch it for yourself. But that's what I saw.
Yeah, no, the whole yeah. thing stunk. Well, and by the way, part and parcel of all this, Dave in South Carolina points out, subject line, Kennedy retirement. Anthony Kennedy's retirement was sketchy as fuck.
Yes. You brought it up on your program.
Yeah.
You know, your program is like, you don't say it enough. It is like months, sometimes years ahead to get other people to start talking about stuff that you've already addressed. It's rather astounding.
Oh, and by the way, you know, we had all the business with the war criminals being pardoned and everything by Nitwit Nero, including ultimately the Secretary of the Navy losing his job. I have a hard time working up a big sympathy for that Richard Spencer, because he went to work for Donald Trump. You know, he knew.
You know what happens when you work for Trump, right?
He knew he was a rattlesnake when he went to work for him. It's that.
You knew I was a snake.
Yeah. Well, you know, Matt Bevin's conceded the Kentucky governor's race, and he's not going to be governor of Kentucky stand for very long, very much longer. But he decided on the way out the door, he'd one up Nitwit Nero. Nitwit Nero pardoned war criminals. Matt Bevin's of Kentucky just pardoned a guy who was convicted of sodomizing his little girl.
Wait, what? Wait a minute, I didn't hear you. So there's something wrong with the connection here.
No, nothing wrong with the connection. Headline, Kentucky governor pardons man serving life sentence for sexually abusing six-year-old girl. His six-year-old stepdaughter. Matt Bevins declared that he was wrongly convicted and commuted his life sentence.
You know what that sounds like, right?
Well, what Bevins said was, it appears to me and to many others, including the judge who sentenced him, that Paul Donnell Hurt has been wrongly convicted and imprisoned for nearly 20 years.
But wait,
there's more. It's a Ginsu commercial.
There's more? Okay. All right, Ron.
Okay. So the guy gets busted, goes on trial, gets tried, gets convicted. After he's convicted, the guy who convicted and sentenced him, the judge there, starts a correspondence with the victim.
Damn.
And eventually convinces her to recant. And so it was all reviewed by another judge who said that her recantation was highly unusual and that the former judge overcame her and caused her to claim falsely that she had lied at trial.
Well, that's called re-victimizing the victim. And, you know, people like that are very vulnerable. And that's why people aren't supposed to have any contact with someone that you have allegedly abused. That's fucked up. But see, they cover for themselves. Child molesters, you know, they're like a clique. You know, anyway, you understand what I'm saying. That's so sad. Jesus Christ.
Oh, and by the way, the guy, our buddy D'Angelo reminds us, John Fund, the guy who wrote the National Review piece,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's got a history of domestic violence. But, you know, it's okay if you're a Republican.
Well, yeah.
Now, on the other hand, if you're a Democrat and you go to take a photo with somebody and you put your hand around their waist, well, you have to quit the fucking Senate.
When we look back at that, man, we lost one of the most astute questioners that we had over some. And then we look back, it's just bullshit. Which, I mean, he was stupid to do it. He made some foolish decisions. But now, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that, come on, Franken, you know, he should still be there. That's just ridiculous. The things that we're dealing with. And when juxtaposed with what he did, you know, he's a comedian. Sometimes you have a good joke and sometimes it's just totally off base. And, you know, things happen like that. What a mess. So that is, I wish Franken was still in there. You know, it's a big mess. And,
you know what I wish? Mm-hmm. I wish Michael, I wish AOB, you know, that's my our nickname for Michael Bloomberg, another old billionaire. I wish AOB would take some of his gajillions and put up billboards all over Fresno that just said, "Dear Fresnians, the hell were you thinking?" What's wrong with you? Because you caught the Devin Nunez stuff over the weekend, right?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sick of him. Oh
he's gonna sue the newspaper just like he sued Twitter over that fake cow account. $50,000+. Likely taxpayer money he spent propping up the Ukrainian fraud. And see, he's in the hands of the goddess of irony at this point, because when Fiona Hill, Dr. Fiona Hill was testifying, She said outright that the Ukrainian thing is nothing but it's a fiction, it's a scam. And he had a copy of her opening statement. So before she got to say a word, he said, not neither, Ukraine, Ukraine. And then lo and behold, yeah. Before a week was out, we had the release, well, it was Friday, we had the release of documents that showed that he is up to his nasty eyebrows in propagating the Ukraine scam.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I mean, it's like when Nitwit Nero says, well, you know, there's CrowdStrike, and that's a Ukrainian company. No, CrowdStrike is an American company. They do cybersecurity and shit like that. Guess who in the past CrowdStrike has done cybersecurity for? I mean, really, care to guess, Todd?
I'm waiting for you to tell me.
How about the Republican National Committee?
Well, I don't doubt that at all. I don't doubt that at all. These folks are depraved. They're out of control. They will say anything. Nunez, I repeat, Nunez had the nerve to talk about, to use the same verbiage, adjective descriptors that were placed on us, talking about us. You know, he's just, something is wrong with him. I mean, I'm telling you, he's got these close-set, dead eyes. The fucker is dead. He has no soul. Look in his eyes. What do you see? I just see a bunch of two black little saucers and nothing behind it. The fuck is wrong with him? You know, I'm just never, I mean, how the hell did he, people keep voting for him?
Crooked as a python with a broken back.
Right. But see, you know, we're letting America is letting itself down at this point because folks just aren't paying attention. Or, you know, or they just want to believe. They you know, people are hungry spiritually for a better country. And they're willing to, like, take anything that's fed to them without doing any research. And maybe they don't have the tools to do the proper research. I don't know what's going on, but it's just very sad. It's because between the gerrymandering and the meddling, and the DNC, what the fuck is Perez doing? You know, we can't have us. 3,600 people running for the Democratic nomination. That's just silly. It makes no fucking sense. This late in the game, it should be like four people. It's too much. And, you know, it's not going to happen. This asshole's going to win again.
Well, I'm going to mention something that probably no one else will. So it's another one of those
again?
Moments. Well, it's another one of those moments that you were talking about we should talk about more on this program. With the arrival of AOB in the Democratic race,
mm-hmm.
we have a little problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, you know, his foreign policy views are downright Republican. Okay? They just are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, he has done some good things over the years. And this is, it has potential to create conflict and divide inside the Democratic Party.
He's a mixed bag.
Well, but it's not his bag. It is his bag that's the problem. It's his big bag of money. For instance, most people who refer to themselves and accept the moniker of environmentalist, you know, I'm not crazy about that word. I could be referred to as one, but I consider myself far more of a human rights activist, because it is how poisonous it's how poison in the environment affects human beings
right.
that primarily motivates me.
I absolutely agree with you.
I love the birds, the bugs, the beetles, and the butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
but it's babies being born with birth defects because of toxic particulates coming off of mountaintop removal sites. It's the cancer, it's the brain disease, the heart disease, the lung disease. That's what motivates me. That's what upsets me. But a lot of the people who call themselves environmentalists, Todd, are generally a lot more progressive than AOB is. This is a problem. Because, you know the difference between a 501c3 and a 501c4, right?
Right.
A 501c3 is a tax-exempt charitable organization, and it can't engage in politics unless it's a Republican church. Then IOKIYAR. But there are also these things called 501c4s.
Fours.
And they are advocacy organizations. And quite frequently, a 501c3 will also have a 501c4. And so the 501c4 can endorse candidates.
Yep.
Well,
and they remain loosely affiliated with their brother or sister.
Right. I mean, they coordinate. I mean, that's why they exist. This isn't like, you know, the 527s or, you know, those dark money organizations. But here's where the problem arises. Most environmentalists are a lot more liberal than AOB is.
Mm-hmm.
However, well, for instance, how is the Sierra Club supposed to endorse someone with a strong environmental bent, a strong environmental policy? Let's say you support the general idea of a Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're going to want to look to the Elizabeth Warrens and the Bernie Sanderses for that, right? And maybe somewhere along the way you look to the Sierra Club for some of your guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, over the last 10 years or so, maybe less.
The Sierra Club had some shady shit going on, though.
Well, over the last 10 years or so, the Sierra Club has accepted from Michael Bloomberg more than $100 million.
Mm-hmm.
In support of its Beyond Coal campaign, and I'm not criticizing it.
Mm-hmm.
The Beyond Coal campaign's purpose is to help retire coal-fired power plants, keep more of them from being built, and get away from a coal-based, from the coal-based aspect of our energy grid. All of which are noble and laudable goals. But they're not the same thing as saying we got 9 years to turn shit around. And so with AOB's entry into the race, where does that leave people, for instance, who have, and you know, the Sierra Club relies, you know, it does a lot of good work in the courts. But it relies on a lot of grassroots work.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an anti-coal activist being supported by the Beyond Coal campaign, how do you not feel some level of obligation to AOB? Even though your broader political leanings may be with Elizabeth Warren or Bernie.
Well, he will serve to thoroughly fracture the party. I'm assuming that's where you're going with this.
Yeah, it is where I'm going.
And that's not what we need. That's See, that's right. That is not what we need right now. This is.
And I'm sorry. I just can't see the Democratic Party coalescing around a guy who's trying to buy the nomination.
Well,
I mean, he is so convinced of his own inevitability. He figures he can blow off Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina and just storm in on Super Tuesday and blitz California and Texas and all the other states and walk away with the nomination.
Well, what I remember of Bloomberg, he is a shrewd politician. And he understands that really, honestly, if we're all honest about it, the country... To win this, the way we are gerrymandered, it can't be a woman right now. It can't be a Negro, and or a minority. That's just not the way things are set up right this second for this particular election.
I don't know how you come up with a viable Democratic candidate if those are three doors you've already closed, when those are three of the most important doors for the grassroots of the Democratic Party.
Well, once again, because of the lay of the land, because of the gerrymandering, the mischief, and the general temperament of the populace now. You see, this is my observation. That's not what I want. Because honestly, I think the three best candidates are probably Warren, Booker, and Julian. You know, he's already been, he's been in the cabinet. You just look at what he is on paper, wow.
Yeah.
But I just don't, remember people are, we're in a bad place right now. We're in a bad place.
I just have this creeping horror that we're going to wind up with a nominee that most of us don't want, but that we're told that we have to have because we'll be told that that's the only person who can beat Trump.
Well, that's exactly what's going to happen.
I don't know if you saw the Saturday Night Live skit earlier this weekend, but that line, they bring Woody Harrelson in to play Biden.
Oh my God. They brought Woody back.
And he said, and I know that people are afraid, people cringe when I talk because they're afraid that I'll say something off color or even worse, on color. And I mean, I like Booker, I like Julian Castro, and I understand why they're sticking around as long as they can. Thinking that there may be one of those Clintonian comeback kid moments. Because nobody gave him a chance going into New Hampshire either. But boom, there he was.
And Buttigieg, now he's young, he sounds good, he's energetic, and he's very, I would say, cerebral. He seems to think things through, but... He doesn't have the support of the black community, which, is a large part of the Democratic Party. But, the South, now that I'm firmly entrenched in the South, I see how conservative it is here, and you cannot win.
That's why I said what I said, Todd, about the fact that this, if you talk about South Carolina, you're not talking about... You are far better served talking about the overall conservatism of the state versus talking about the blackness or whiteness of the state.
Absolutely.
And I dare say, although I can't speak from experience, obviously, but I got a feeling that if you wanted a better barometer of the attitude of the black community in America on Democratic candidates, you'd probably be better off asking the substantial and sizable black community in Maryland, or the sizable and substantial black community in Illinois, I mean, I can think of lots of places that you might you might get a better metric than South Carolina.
It's not representative of right.
Well, first of all, as compared to the rest of the country, it's wildly overchurched.
Yep. Are you kidding?
And you know this better than I do because you're there.
People don't understand unless you're here, man. This is a very, it doesn't matter what your ethnicity is. This is a conservative, it doesn't, you know, it's just conservative. That's what it is. Even the, man, there are a lot of Spanish-speaking folk, you know, Hispanics, people from Central America, Mexico here now, that, you know, just really have roots and businesses and stores. And remember, they're hardcore Catholics, most of them. And if they're not, they're still conservative. They're conservative, too. So people have to do a little sociological digging, maybe scratching a little surface to really see what's happening. And I like what you said about Maryland, because, you know, Maryland's interesting because, you know, Baltimore and Washington is so close. And then the suburbs, you know, there's a lot going on there. And you're talking about, you know, a lot of highly educated people. Some folks work for the government, some don't. But, you know, they're totally different than where I, you know, South Carolina is different. And because the first thing they say, who are your people? That's the first thing they say here. And then if you're from the north, they say, well, why are you here? Like, well, why are you here?
There we go. Yeah. Hey, Todd, I got to roll out of here because we are short this evening, but good to talk to you, brother.
You too. You take care, my friend.
All right. Later.
Okay. Bye. Bye now.
And so remember, tune back into Progressive Voices. Don't listen on the horn stream. Tune back into Progressive Voices at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific, and we'll pick up another hour of conversation radio. I got some fun stuff lined up. Thanks to all of you, subscribers and a la carte contributors alike, who help keep this little effort going month in, month out, year after year. Thank you so much. Thank you to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this years-long conversation. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks, Sparky, in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. 20 years now at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.